Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Early Swarm Radio here on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk Radio. I'm Greg Roman, your host, and we have Marilyn Stern, our producer, and Garrett Gamble, our co-host, who are providing commentary by way of the internet. We are proud to have Anna Wyszewskaja, senior fellow at the Washington Institute, and also a fellow at the European Institute for Democracy, joining us at the bottom half of the hour. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And I understand that you are somewhere in an undisclosed region of Virginia joining us this morning.
That is correct. So I apologize if the internet cell phone connection goes in and out a little bit, but so far I hear you very well.
All right, wonderful. And you have just published, a little over a week ago, a new analysis from the Washington Institute's Policy Analysis, Policy Watch, section number 3334. Russia's military activity in the East Mediterranean echoes its approach to Syria. So with a little bit of background, can you tell us about how Russia started its base in Tartus and in the Latakia province some 45, 50 years ago under the previous Assad? And then now how it's renewed that port. It has attempted to expand its influence in Libya, and it's sort of creating a flanking maneuver against NATO's interests in the Eastern Med, and why it's doing it and what its next steps are. Can you give us a general overview?
So, sure. So very briefly, in broad strokes, historically, the Russian state has always had an interest in the Eastern Mediterranean, even before the Soviet Union. And certainly the Soviet Union, as you say, was in particular interested in this region because this is NATO's southern flank. This is what the Russians historically called Russia's soft underbelly, but also a relatively weaker position for NATO. So Hafez al-Assad, Assad's father, had emerged as the closest Arab ally of the Soviet Union, and the Russians had established the base in Tartus that you had mentioned. It's actually more of a facility than really a full-fledged base at the time. With Russia's military intervention in 2015, Russia not only reinforced its presence in Tartus, but also created an air base in Khmeinim, and has subsequently looked for other ways to boost its military presence in Syria on the Eastern Mediterranean. What we're seeing now is Russia has been using Syria as a springboard for further expansion. And when it comes to Libya, Russia has multiple interests to go into it in more detail, but in short, access to the Eastern Mediterranean and checking NATO's southern flank is an important component of these priorities that Russia has.
Okay, so let's go over a list of these priorities. There's energy, there's strategic parity and strategic depth against NATO's forces there, there's the inability for Russia to get beyond the Bosphorus, and there's the desire to have a position to agitate against the U.S. on a western flank. It's not just the southern flank. It's also the U.S. Mm-hmm. being boxed in and creating a buffer between the Russian forces that are docked in Syria, a potential dock in Haftar's Libya, and then the U.S. Mm-hmm. having its own forces in Italy and in Cyprus, and also Crete to a certain extent in Greece. Can you give us more a policy by policy analysis of where Russia hopes to gain an advantage against the U.S. and NATO?
So one chief priority, and this is more of a long game, is exactly as you said, basing access, NATO's checking NATO's southern flank, and looking for ways to outmaneuver the United States, more broadly Western allies. Libya provides a useful position for this for multiple reasons. For one thing, Russia's, together with Tartus, having more basing rights in Libya. Some analysts call Libya's ports deep water ports. In other words, it provides additional advantages that Tartus does not have. having the advantage of using refugees. This has been another issue in the last several years with regard to Libya in particular, using the refugee issue to pressure Europeans. Energy issues, as you said, are incredibly important. Libya has Libya's east in particular, where Haftar has control, has enormous energy reserves. Syria's energy reserves are fairly minuscule. They matter more for their geostrategic location than for their quantity, but Libya's energy resources are very important. Now, what's happening in terms of Russia's other bigger play? Russia has been looking to position itself as quote unquote peacemaker. And this is a little bit different from Syria, where in Syria, Moscow had clearly taken a side with regard to Assad. In Libya, Moscow has certainly been closer to Haftar. But they haven't been wedded to Haftar in the same way. In fact, Russia has built connections with everybody on the ground, including with the Sarraj government. And I would argue that Russia's interest in Libya, and this is a little bit different from Syria, is, for one thing, again, they're not wedded to Haftar to the same extent. And certainly he's proven a problematic actor. But in terms of the bigger interest, it's also fomenting instability. Because unlike in Syria, in Libya, the existing internationally recognized government did not invite Russia. So Russia has more of an interest in keeping a low-level conflict, basically a frozen conflict type scenario that we see in Russia's periphery, because that gives Russia a foothold. It gives Russia time to build up its presence. It also everybody needs Russia in a situation like that. Everybody's looking to Russia as quote unquote manager of a conflict. But managing a conflict is very different from resolving it. So Russia here has a specific interest in maintaining instability despite all talk about peacemaking efforts. And that's that this is another big picture issue when it comes to Libya.
And what about some of the other countries that we haven't addressed? For instance, Russia's increased military sales to Egypt, its interest in the Gulf of Yemen, its participation in anti-piracy missions off the coast of Somalia. The Eastern Mediterranean and the Suez is a gate to Russian interests that may abut both those of America, the European Union, and China, in the Southern Red Sea.
That's right. That's right. And what's interesting, Russia has been for years, I guess let me start with saying that Russia for years has been working to build a good relationship with Egypt, precisely because Russia understands the geostrategic importance of this country, because there's also a historic relationship with Egypt that goes back to the Soviet Union. And for a whole host of these other geostrategic reasons, Russia has worked very hard and also made headways with regard to building a closer relationship with Egypt. The current Egypt is, it's not that they've switched camps, but it is an Egypt that leans a little bit more to the Russian side. And what you're seeing is with regard to Libya is background. Russia, Libya has turned into a proxy battleground for all these different actors, from Egypt, Turkey, for UAE. In effect,
Anna, we have a little bit of hard time hearing you. Maybe try to get to a place where your reception's just a little bit better, perhaps closer to a window or somewhere near a door. Would that be okay? Okay, we may have lost her. We're going to have our engineer call back in. We'll go to a quick message and we'll be right back.
The Middle East Forum promotes American interests in the Middle East and protects Western values from Middle Eastern threats. The forum sees the region, with its profusion of dictatorships, radical ideologies, existential conflicts, and weapons of mass destruction, as a major source of problems for the United States. Accordingly, we urge bold measures to protect Americans and their allies. Read more at www.meforum.org or check us out on Twitter at MEForum, the Middle East Forum, protecting your interests.
During the Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. After World War II, they call it gross stress reaction. It's been called shell shock, war neurosis, and battle fatigue. Today, we call it post-traumatic stress disorder, and it affects one out of every five warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not a wound that you can see, though it can have an even more significant impact. Post-traumatic stress disorder can prevent warriors from living a normal life, hurt their relationships, and affect their ability to hold a steady job. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with post-traumatic stress disorder and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out what you can do to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Women Heart is in a race to save lives. Heart disease is the number one killer of women. It's 80% preventable, if you know the facts. Millions of women are living with or at risk of different types of heart disease, like AFib, which is a type of irregular heartbeat. It affects both women and men, but women with AFib have a higher risk of stroke and death than men. Get educated. See your doctor. Know the facts. Diet and exercise are key to staying healthy. Know the risks. Women Heart does something really unique, solely focusing on women and providing peer-to-peer support. To win this race, we all have to do it together. Our hearts beat as one. To learn more, visit womenheart.org.
DB 860 AM. Having some difficulties, technical difficulties this morning with our call with Anna from the Washington Institute, but we will be joined shortly by Winfield Myers, the director of Campus Watch, talking about a new initiative with Congressman Doug Lamborn, who has reached out regarding the University of California at Berkeley and its efforts by Congress to investigate its Middle East Studies Department for a few reasons. Number one, this has typically been a bastion of not just anti-Zionism, but also anti-Semitism, a publicly funded, a federally funded state university, which has had monies granted to it by the federal government to diversify its programs for teaching Arabic, for educating individuals about the Middle East by sending them abroad, and by exposing Americans to foreign cultures. And it's been doing it through a political lens rather through one of just solely needing to be academic. More than that, there's also the cultural side that has to be looked at. And Winfield will be telling us about this initiative. It's actually the fourth letter that Campus Watch and the Middle East Forum's Washington Project has generated in the past year. We've also covered the University of Arizona. That was Congressman Paul Gosar. The Georgetown University, which was done by Congressman Denver Riggleman, who unfortunately lost his primary a few weeks ago, but he's still in Congress for another 6 months or so, and he'll be focused on that. And one more, but with us focusing very much so on the basic elements of us trying to, I think, focus on higher education and also the Middle East studies profession and its reform. Now, we've been at this effort for the better part of 10 years. I'd even say 12 years since Title VI reform became a priority of the Middle East Forum. And Winfield will give us the update on that. He's been working with Cliff Smith, the director of the Washington Project, on this. And I would try to get Cliff on, but maybe we'll have him on next week instead. As we try to get Winfield on, there's been a few new hires at the Middle East Forum. We have Abdullah Bozkurt, who has joined us, the director of the Stockholm Center for Freedom from Norway. Excuse me, from Sweden, who has been joining us. We also have a new fellow from Israel, Amatzia Baram, who focuses on Iraq. And we're also looking to add those from the Libya, Algeria, and the Morocco fields, and that'll be an announcement that we make in the next few weeks. Anna has actually returned to finish up our interview on Russia and the Middle East. Anna, we lost you when we were talking about the segmentation of Russia's interests in Libya, how it's become a proxy battleground for Turkey, the UAE, Egypt, Russia, the United States, even Italy and France to a certain extent. But I wanted to focus a little bit farther east. Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. Does Russia have designs to influence those countries?
It does. It absolutely does. And I mean, look, Algeria, frankly, I think of all these countries, I would argue never really fully left the Russian camp. With regard to Tunisia and Morocco, it's certainly a more complicated story. But Russia has been working through a number of channels to increase influence. And I'll give a few examples. With Tunisia, several years ago, when Russian tourists could no longer go to Turkey and Egypt after an embargo that Putin had placed on Turkey, and after a Russian plane was attacked, there was a terrorist attack on a Russian plane from leaving the Sinai. A very large number of Russian tourists had gone into Tunisia. And in fact, when I traveled to Tunisia several years ago, if you walked through the shops in the city center, in the capital center, Tunisian shopkeepers spoke Russian. With Morocco as well, the Moroccan king had traveled to Moscow several years ago. This was a very important visit. I had also seen some indications that the Russians are trying to encourage tourism with Morocco. So again, these are smaller steps, and this is not to say that we need to get overly, I guess, hysterical. It's not as if the Russians are coming, but certainly Russia is interested in building ties with these countries at the expense of the United States, and they do what they can based on context, and certainly context in Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco are different. And I should add, of course, energy and arms trade, traditional Russian tools are very important for the relationship with Algeria as well.
There's also been deconfliction mechanisms set up between Russia and Israel. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So when Russia entered the Syrian theater, the Syrian military theater in 2015, it very quickly gained control of Syrian airspace through setting up what's referred to in the military as the anti-adversarial denial system, A2AD. Essentially, in short, it means denying your adversary freedom of action, and Russia has control of this airspace. So for Israel, the importance for Israel is being able to continue to strike Iranian-backed targets in Syria. It was very important not to have clashes with Russia, not just for the United States, but also for Israel. More or less, this mechanism worked. But the fact of the matter is Russia controls Syrian airspace, and not the other way around. And there was a major incident that you probably recall when a little over a year ago, Assad has shut down a Russian plane, and Russia blamed Israel for this incident. Since then, it seems to have smoothed over, but it certainly showed you what can happen, how precarious the situation is.
Now, at the end of your piece, you make the policy recommendation that the United States do everything it can to stop private military contractors using force if necessary to be able to tamper or eject Russian influence from Libya. And I expect that you would also make similar recommendations, maybe not using force per se, to curtail its influence on Egypt and some of these other countries we've spoken about. Can you elaborate on that recommendation and how the U.S. would go about executing it?
Sure. And I apologize. I missed part of your questions. You cut off a little bit. It's my poor connection. But I think if I understood, you were asking me to elaborate on Russian PMCs and how the United States could boost its position. What I was trying to say is two things. Russia has been using a lot of covert activity in Libya through PMCs, in part because it's in a more difficult position. Also because PMCs have proven to be a useful tool, but Libya is not Syria for a number of reasons. And it's more challenging for Russia, and they've discovered that, especially with the Turkey's offensive in recent weeks. So PMCs are going to continue to be a useful tool for the Kremlin, you know, one thing I would think about when I was writing the piece is, look, there was an incident with Syria in Deir ez-Zor with Russian PMCs where after repeated American warnings, they continued breaking an international agreement and continued with an offensive, and eventually the United States had no choice but to push back militarily and shoot at these PMCs, these quote unquote contractors. Again, it happened during the process, and it was in self-defense. My point was that sometimes you have to use force if necessary in situations like that, and the United States was justified, and I can foresee potentially a similar situation in Libya. And certainly, if anybody's worried about a war, a full-scale war breaking out between the United States and Russia because of these incidents, it did not happen in Syria. In fact, the Russian government went to great lengths to at first deny that this happened and then minimize the impact. The other issue is simply the issue of legality and invitation, because again, in Syria, Russia repeatedly says that they've been invited by quote-unquote legitimate government of Assad. Well, there hasn't been the same invitation in Libya. So there's also an issue of just how legal are these activities of Russian PMCs.
Anna, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Sorry about the connection, but we look forward to having you back on air.
My pleasure, and look forward to being back.
For more information, go to the Washington Institute's website. We'll have it on the MEF website with the summary. But thank everyone for joining us today, and have a great week here for Middle East Forum Radio. This is Greg Roman on WWDB 860 AM signing off.